This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before the U.S. began to bomb Iraq, my guest, Senator Robert Byrd, made a now-famous speech in which he criticized the Bush administration for embarking on the first test of a revolutionary doctrine of preemptive war. He criticized his fellow senators for being ominously, dreadfully silent. No debate, no discussion. Byrd voted for the Patriot Act, but says he wishes he had not. He opposed the Bush tax cuts and sent back his own $600 tax rebate check in 2001. Now Senator Byrd has written a new book called Losing America, Confronting a Reckless and Arrogant Presidency. Byrd is a Democrat from West Virginia who has served in the U.S. Congress for 51 years, 45 of them as a senator. At the age of 86, he is the third longest-serving member of Congress in American history. He serves on the Senate Appropriations Committee, its Homeland Security Subcommittee, the Senate Armed Services Committee, and is co-chair of the Senate National Security Working Group. In your now famous speech of February 12, 2003, about 35 days before we bombed Iraq, you called President Bush reckless and arrogant, and you criticized your fellow senators. You said, "We stand passively mute in the U.S. Senate, paralyzed by our uncertainty, seemingly stunned by the sheer turmoil of events." This speech appeared on many internet sites. It was translated into many different languages. Even for people who weren't necessarily paying that much attention to your career, you became famous. What difference do you think this speech actually made in the Senate?
And I'm not sure that I could measure that. I thought that it's something that I felt strongly. I was astonished to see a Senate, which I've long come to revere, stand mute. The men who were there and the one woman who was there when I came to the Senate would not have stood still. How changed the Senate was, how intimidated the members were, how afraid they were, many of them, of being called unpatriotic if they didn't support the commander-in-chief.
Now, you had been concerned that by giving the president authority to launch a preemptive attack on a sovereign nation, that it would redefine the nature of defense and reinterpret the Constitution to suit the will of the executive branch. Do you feel like we've set that precedent now?
Yes. Oh, yes. But we've got to get back from that. We've got to withdraw from that foolish moment and the foolish act that we did. We've got to take that power back from the president. You see, the framers wrote the Constitution, and when they gave to the Congress the power to declare war, they were giving to the Congress the power to declare war, and they were not thinking in terms of one person or even one body. It takes two bodies, the House and the Senate, to declare war, and it takes many people. And here we were, acquiescing to an administration that doesn't really understand the role of the Senate, and we were shifting to one man, this awesome power. And then we were relegating to ourselves the position of doing nothing. We relegated ourselves to the sidelines, and that's where we are today.
On March 18, 2003, you said this on the subject of a preemptive attack on Iraq. You said, "I have urged the president to step back and reconsider his decisions, but the administration has its eyes shut, its ears covered, and its mind closed." What are some examples of how you think the administration closed its mind?
It doesn't listen. It doesn't listen to Congress. It looks upon the Congress with disdain. It just pains me that here's an administration that doesn't seem to understand the Constitution. It doesn't understand that the Constitution is we, the people of the United States. It doesn't understand that preamble. And some examples? Well, one example would be the creating of the Department of Homeland Security. It was hatched out in the bowels of the White House by four men, especially Tom Ridge, fine man, former governor of the state of Pennsylvania. He was one. Another was the chief counsel, a man by the name of Gonzalez. Another was the head of the Office of Management and Budget. That, and the final one was the man who's down at the White House, the head of staff, Andrew Card. Those four hatched this idea, and the Congress wasn't counseled, wasn't asking the questions.
I know you voted in favor of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which authorized the president to use force to repel armed attack and prevent further aggression in Vietnam. My understanding is that you came to regret that vote.
I do regret that, and Senator Morris, who was one of the two, the other one was Ernest Greening of Alaska, Senator Morris said that we would live to regret our vote. We have. I regretted my vote. But let me say this about that. We were misled by an administration. We've been misled in this instance when the President of the United States and those super hawks around him brought us into this war, which should never have been fought. But let's go back to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. One thing about that, it had a sunset provision which allowed the Congress in a concurrent resolution, which did not have to go to the president and did not have to be signed by the president, could sunset that provision. In this case, in the resolution that was passed on October 11, 2002, there's no provision to sunset the action. I said, look, if we're going to be fools enough to shift this power to one man, to a president of the United States, and George Bush in particular, we ought to at least sunset it. Only to 1 year does this provision, does this resolution remain. And after 1 year, or under certain circumstances, if the president certifies thus and so, it could be extended 2 years. So I offered an amendment to sunset it, and only 31 votes, including my own, were cast. I couldn't understand. I couldn't believe it that the Senate was willing not only to give this power to the president, but also to leave it there.
You've criticized the Senate for becoming the errand boy of the White House.
Yes.
Does the Bush administration interact with the Senate any differently than the other 10 presidents that you've worked with in your years?
I think that the Bush administration expects every Republican senator to toe the mark. And I feel that the unwritten rule on the other side of the aisle, as I've observed it, I think that they feel that the first thing, the last thing, and the thing to do always is to support the president. And they speak the words, commander-in-chief, as though they were, those words were sacred. And it saddens me when a political party follows a president as though he were the king. And I've said from time to time, the commander-in-chief, why? The commander, there was a commander-in-chief in the Civil War in England, and Charles I used that term in 1639. The term commander-in-chief, that's nothing new. That term did not originate with the framers in Philadelphia. It's meant to indicate that the civilian, that the military is under the civilian rule. That's what it's there for. It's not some sacred thing that has some innate power within itself. But these days, my friends across the aisle use that term, the commander-in-chief. Well, he's not the commander-in-chief of the Senate. He's not the commander-in-chief of industry in this country. He is the civilian authority who is over the military. That's it. So that back to your question, yes, the Republicans follow the commander-in-chief come hell or high water, it seems to me, and they all stand in line. I've never seen anything like it.
Is this true? Is this true of Democrats and Republicans?
Well, it's true of Republicans, but it has not always been true of Republicans. I think of men like George Aiken and Norris Cotton and Everett Dirksen. These were men who stood on their own, and if it meant that they would break with the president, they did so.
My guest is Senator Robert Byrd. He's written a new book called Losing America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Senator Robert Byrd, and he's written a new book called Losing America, Confronting a Reckless and Arrogant Presidency. You voted against the creation of the Homeland Security Department, and then you said, nobody can convince me that this White House is serious about Homeland Security. Do you have any regrets about voting against the creation of the Homeland Security Department?
No, I have no regrets. I'm the ranking member on the subcommittee that appropriates money for Homeland Security. And we have a fine chairman of that subcommittee, Thad Cochran, a Republican senator from the state of Mississippi. We work together well. But I foresaw that there would be chaos and confusion in this mammoth department. And it was pushed by the president and his administration because Ted Stevens, a Republican senator from Alaska, and I offered amendments to appropriation bills requiring Tom Ridge or any other person in his place should have to be confirmed by the Senate. So, no, I don't regret having voted that way. I do vote to support the appropriations, however, and we have hearings and try to guide the administration of that department.
Do you not think that intelligence information has become better coordinated as a result of the Homeland Security Department?
I can't see that as yet, but I can see this. The administration does not support its own handiwork. The administration opposes amendments that are offered by Democrats. I've offered many amendments to add monies for Homeland Security, for border control, for the ports of the country, and to promote the safety of the American people. And this administration votes them down. And so this administration talks out of its mouth with a forked tongue. Now, we have right now a bill, an appropriation bill that has been reported out of the Appropriations Committee on which I serve, and that bill it makes appropriations for Homeland Security. But this bill is sitting in the shelf. I urge that it be taken up. And here we are. We're going to be out for 40-45 days. We're going to be out six weeks. And the bill for the safety of the people sits on the shelf because the White House has said, bottle it up. I can't say that those words were used exactly, but the Republican leadership in Congress would certainly have moved if it had been pushed by the administration. I cannot understand. I just simply can't understand this. From an administration that says, watch out, stop, look, and listen. Your country's very likely to be under attack. And here we are, money sitting, going to wait until we come back after the conventions, after August is gone.
You've described the USA Patriot Act as a case study in the perils of speed, herd instinct, and lack of vigilance when it comes to legislating in the face of crisis.
Congress was intimidated here again. It wanted to act. It wanted to show the people that was there, and it was supporting the commander-in-chief. We had just experienced a terrible, terrible tragedy, an attack. Yes, we acted. We were virtually in a panic. And so we passed an act. Some of it was good. Parts of it I don't think were good. I'm not sure I would have voted for it. It would take ahead more time. But we're all being pushed. And of course, the president wants to have it renewed. I'm going to take. We'll take a better look at it when the time comes.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but in 2001, you were president pro tem, and you were third in line, of success in the presidency. What was your reaction when you learned that after September 11th, the Bush administration activated what you've described as a shadow government of about 100 senior executive branch officials to live and work secretly outside Washington in a system reportedly run by the White House?
Well, I was surprised that I had not been contacted by the White House or by the administration. This was typical of the Bush administration. Here they were now. They created a shadow government. They didn't let the president pro tem of the Senate know anything about it. I read about it in the newspaper. This is typical of the administration. It is secretive. It likes to operate out of the White House. I don't think it understands the role of the legislative branch under the Constitution. The sovereignty rests with the people of the United States. And that's why this administration has left the Constitution. It has left the people, and it's driven by an urge to acquire more power.
You were, along with Senator Howard Baker, the person who helped get TV cameras into the Senate. You thought the Senate's work should be televised. Well, what do you think of the results now?
Well, I think the results have been good. The Senate was becoming an invisible part of our government. Here was the House. It had had television 8 or 9 years when Howard Baker and I worked together on this and together with Senator Dole. After all, we the people, as I read it, we the people need to be an informed population. When the people are properly informed, then we're going to reach the right decisions, because we, especially in the legislative branch, represent the people. That's what's wrong with this administration. It forgets that it's the people. The people are sovereign, not George Bush. Just take a passage from Bob Woodward's book. This paragraph is the whole thing. The president in the book Bush at War by Bob Woodward said this: "I'm the commander. See, I don't need to explain. I do not need to explain why I say things." That's the interesting thing about being the president. Maybe somebody needs to explain to me why they say something, but I don't feel like I owe anybody an explanation. Now, get that. That tells you, in a nutshell, what is wrong with the leadership of this country.
Senator Byrd, I'd like to talk a little bit about your life. I know that your mother died in 1918 during the flu epidemic, and then you were basically adopted by, I believe it was an aunt and uncle.
My mother died on Armistice Day, 1918. I lacked a few days being 1 year old. Before my mother died, in anticipation that she might not recover from the flu, she asked my father to, if she didn't recover, to give the baby, quote, end quote. I was the baby. I had three older brothers and a sister. I was the baby. And it was her wish that the Byrds, one of my father's sisters and her husband, take me and raise me. And so on the night of Armistice Day, my mother went to heaven. And it is because of her wish that I'm a senator today. My mother's prayer, my mother's wish was that I be something. She said I was going to be the president of the United States. And she died. I know that that her prayers have followed me. Now, the people who took me, they were good people. The man who took me was named Titus Dalton Byrd, B-Y-R-D. And he married one of my natural father's sisters. Her name was Valerma, and I was given the name of Robert Carlyle Byrd by them. And I've met kings and shahs and presidents and governors, and the greatest man I've ever met was that man who raised me, Titus Dalton Byrd. He was poor, but he was honest.
How old were you when they told you that you were adopted?
I think I was a senior in high school when Mr. Byrd took me aside, as it were, and told me all about it, and offered to take me down to North Carolina to meet from West Virginia, to meet my natural father, Cornelius Calvin Sale. My name had been Cornelius Calvin Sale, Jr.
Senator Robert Byrd will be back in the second half of the show. He's written a new book called Losing America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Senator Robert Byrd, a Democrat from West Virginia. He's written a new book called Losing America, Confronting a Reckless and Arrogant Presidency. Byrd has served in the U.S. Congress for 51 years, 45 of them as senator. In the history of America, only two men have served in the U.S. Congress longer than the now 86-year-old Byrd. When we left off, we were talking about growing up in West Virginia. Now, you grew up during the Depression. Early in your, teenage years and early adult life, you made a living in a number of different ways. You were a gas station attendant. You were a welder. You ran a store. I think you owned a store, actually, with your wife. Then you went to law school and then first ran for the state house in West Virginia, then for Congress, then for Senate.
Yes.
I believe it was early in your political career that you briefly joined the Ku Klux Klan. Now, most people know that was a brief part of your history. Why did you join?
I joined for a number of reasons. In that day and time, things were different than they are now. There was a time when Mr. Byrd, who raised me, joined the Klan. And in those days, many of the upstanding in the men and women in the communities, was told then, were members, lawyers, judges, bankers, and others were in the Klan. And so I joined it. I've regretted that. I've apologized for it. There's nothing more I can do, except I speak plainly when I condemn the Klan and its tactics. I think, improved and grown since that time. And I would urge young men not to join the Klan, but I've always been so sorry that I joined the Klan.
You know, you've been talking earlier about how divisive America is and how disappointed you are in the Senate for not speaking up and acting independently of the president's wishes. But when you flip back to this period of America, and are we talking about the 1950s? 40s?
1940s.
1940s. I mean, to think that a young congressman like yourself felt that it was an important part.
No. I was not a congressman when I joined. This was before I got into politics.
This is when you were in business?
Well, no, I wasn't
even
in business.
That?
I was a meat cutter.
Uh-huh.
I was a meat cutter. You see, at first I started out, as you say, in the gas station.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was a produce salesman. Then I was a meat cutter. All this was in the coal camps in southern West Virginia, where the atmosphere was southern, where we had where many of the people who boarded at my mom's house. I call my aunt my mom. I never knew any other mother but this woman. She never kissed me in my life, but she was stern, very religious. And she didn't wear it on her sleeve. She didn't go around condemning other people and wearing religion on her sleeve. But she was a great woman. And so times were different then, but I was not in Congress at that time. My having erred by joining the Ku Klux Klan had long been publicized during the campaigns when I ran for Congress. But I didn't join the Klan when I was in Congress.
Do you have any plans of retiring?
I do not.
And finally, as a lot of our listeners know, in addition to having served in the Senate for many years, you have also fiddled for many years. You love bluegrass music. And you recorded an album in 1978 that we have a copy of. And I'd like to end with some music from that recording. Is there a track from the album that you recorded in 1978 that you'd like us to close with? Do you have a favorite track?
There's More Pretty Girls Than One on there. And I think that'd be good. Yes, and I hope that my wife's listening. We've been married, 67 years. I love her. And I'd like to send this to her, if I might have that privilege.
Of course. So you're dedicating this one to your wife?
Yes.
Absolutely. Senator Byrd, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
There's more pretty girls than one. There's more pretty girls than one. Every town I ramble around, there's more pretty girls than one.
Senator Robert Byrd singing and playing fiddle. He's written a new book called Losing America. We invited over a dozen Republican senators to talk with us today. Their offices were very gracious, but our timing was bad. They were all using this recess period as a chance to go on the road in their states, visiting constituents. We hope to find a time that is more convenient in the near future.